Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. This is a continuation of episode 136, in which we are revisiting Weber's chapter on bureaucracy, published in his 1922 book, Economy and Society, that we originally covered in our episode 6. This is part 4 of the present episode. It begins with a re-release of Demetrius's summary of Weber and his motivations for writing the chapter and theorizing about bureaucracy. It is followed by additional reflections by Tom on contemporary antipathy toward bureaucracy and emerging directions in organizing. First, here is the edited version of the original summary of episode 6 by Demetrius.
So Max Weber, the author of our text, was a Prussian/German sociologist and philosopher famous for being one of the three founders of sociology, alongside Karl Marx and Emil Durkheim. We read from his major work, two volumes entitled Economy and Society, published posthumously in 1922 by his wife Marianne. Interestingly, a full translation into English was not available until 1968, which in many ways makes this a reasonably contemporary text. In the episode, we discussed two chapters from The Economy and Society. Chapter 3, on three forms of legitimate domination, and chapter 11, on bureaucracy itself. In chapter 3, he briefly describes the characteristics of bureaucratic organization and the specific position of the bureaucrat under the legal authority with a bureaucratic administrative staff. Here, Weber contrasts a bureaucratic form based on norms with a traditional and charismatic one, and the discussion develops from his general concern with power and authority. The argument goes along the lines of, the most primitive type of authority is charismatic, where a person is followed and listened to because of their personal charisma. Because let's face it, it's really fun to follow such leaders. They get everyone excited about what needs to be done in an almost manic manner. The more sophisticated one is hereditary, where authority is passed down along familial lines, such as the case with nobility or in family-owned businesses, for example. The bureaucratic form, or what Weber terms as the rational legal authority, is the form most appropriate to running a contemporary large-scale organization. All that paper and all those rules serve the purpose to ensure that all are treated equally and based on their suitability for the position of leadership, or followership for that matter. Of course, this is not how it works in practice all the time, but that's another matter, one which we do touch upon during the episode. We also find the famous ideal type in this chapter. Ideal type of bureaucracy, that is. Weber describes it as something characterized by a number of organizational features, such as hierarchy, rules, but also behavioral ones, such as impersonalism, as well as aspects related to employment, such as hiring. He generally describes bureaucracy as a form of authority based on impersonal rules and a universe of standardized, formalized work, and mentions at one point that bureaucracy may frequently be reduced to a system of rules and procedures alone. The second chapter we read, chapter 11, entitled Bureaucracy, is from volume 2. Here Weber goes into greater detail and analyzes the individual features of bureaucracy while showing the differences between the modern form of bureaucracy, well, for his day modern, and the historically earlier forms, at length. There are at least two meanings which Weber refers to when speaking about bureaucracy. The notion already existed before Weber, even though he was the one who imported it into social sciences, and it was used with a negative meaning referring to the power that officials had assumed with the emergence of the modern state. We are basically talking about the class of workers that, from their bureaus, regulate how things are run and overview the general government. There is a tricky issue here worth noting, though. When Weber writes, he refers at the same time to his class of officials, and with this he speaks of officialdom, but also to the way in which the work of these employees was structured in modern times and contrast it with other forms of bureaucracy. For example, a patrimonial one during monarchic times in which, for instance, the notion of office did not exist or have any meaning for that matter. So Weber is speaking of a bureaucratic or bureaucratized bureaucrats, or more simply, bureaucratic administrative staff. Finally, the notion of bureaucratized work relates to his interest in the organization of work in more rational ways, which basically gives rise to the ideal type of bureaucracy. Rationality and rationalization are central terms, and part of what he describes as the rationalization of the world refers to the advancement of a level of calculability in all social spheres. Or, to paraphrase into English, with greater rationality comes greater certainty. This is the root of his famous idea, later known in his works as the iron cage, in which a system of technical efficiency grows and encompasses all spheres of life. During the episode, we focused on three main themes: what is bureaucracy for, who is bureaucracy for, and rules. Part one of the episode is primarily about the what and the who, while in part two, we go into more detail about rules, which seems appropriate given the key role rules play in Weber's system. So what is bureaucracy for? This may seem like an odd question. What is a hammer for? It is for hammering. A chair is for sitting. A car is for transportation. And the dog is for being cute and funny, as well as for chewing things you never knew you needed but suddenly realized that you do. Oh well. But what is bureaucracy for? Bureaucracy is for making work more rational, right? Okay, but unlike hammers, chairs, and dogs, who are at least semi-sufficient in their being, work is always a work towards some particular goal, making bureaucracy a tool for rationalizing work towards that particular goal. Now, Weber makes no mention of this in his ideal type. He is simply developing a mechanism that, when applied, would ensure the most efficient and reliable way of achieving whatever it is that needs to be achieved. This, of course, can be anything from a really efficient stock trading system to a really efficient way of exterminating groups of people, as was the case during World War II. See Zygmunt Bauman's work on what made the Holocaust possible for more details. Alternatively, Franz Kafka's novel The Trial is an excellent exposition of how bureaucracy can just be spinning its wheels without a particular end or purpose in sight. Kafka is a highly appropriate reference for Weberian bureaucracy because not only was he a keen observer of the social, but he also lived at the same time as Weber, in the same country, and presumably observed the same kinds of organizations that Weber was inspired by. Another aspect of what is bureaucracy for is human motivation. We discussed why people would want to work in a bureaucracy given some of its more obvious limitations, absence of purpose not being the least of those. One reason we came up with was power. Bureaucracy carries with it quite a lot of power, which, even maintaining Weber's insistence on separating the personal from the professional, can still be impressive to bear. The other is job security. Weber wanted lifetime devotion from his ideal bureaucrats, who would work for the organization for the duration of their natural lives, in return for not having to worry about downsizings and other such unpleasantries. Think of classical corporations in the US during the 50s, 60s, and parts of 70s, where it was completely acceptable to turn up for work every day for the duration of your working life in order to receive salary, pension, and a fancy wristwatch in gratitude for your service to the bureaucracy. Transitioning to who is bureaucracy for, we talked about two key things. One, how bureaucracy is less about efficiency and more about reduction of uncertainty, and two, how bureaucratic experience is different for senior managers and line workers and everyone in between, basically subject to how far they are up the bureaucracy. Comparing Weber to Taylor, whom we read for episode 1, for Taylor, workers needed to be told what to do and exactly how to do it, because Taylor believed that they were not particularly clever. For Weber, however, this was not the case. In a bureaucracy, information is distributed along the lines of offices, so that each office looks after the information and knowledge appropriate to fulfilling its function. While this means that, yes, higher offices will have a broader view of the organization, it does not mean that higher offices necessarily know best how to do work. This is on the one hand, that is. On the other, Pedro brought up an example of how lower-level employees experience a lot of anxiety as a result of them simply not knowing what to do, or whether to show up for work the next day. The reason they don't have that information is because their office is perceived not to qualify for having it by the bureaucracy in place. This, of course, generates a lot of uncertainty for those on the receiving end. And speaking of uncertainty, a frequently overlooked fact about Weberian bureaucracy is that it is not really concerned with efficiency. Because Weber wrote in German, the translation of his work arrived to the English-speaking world after Taylor had written his Principles of Scientific Management. The reading of Weber as developing a system for greater efficiency is a consequence of this, because Weber was only marginally concerned with efficiency. His main thing was reduction of uncertainty. To illustrate, Ralph gave an example of how nuclear power evolved in the United States as opposed to Britain and France. The bumpy road taken by American companies in pursuit of nuclear energy generation was avoided in Europe because the governments of Britain and France bureaucratized everything to do with nuclear power plants straight away, avoiding uncertainty over technology and safety that had to be navigated by US companies independently. It is these rules and standards that we mainly concerned ourselves with in part 2 of the episode. Some of the main topics were how does understanding of the rules relate to the ability to follow the rules, and what about situations where there are too many rules? In terms of the former, we discussed how Weber does not mention whether an understanding of the rule is important or not. Granted, for him the ability to follow the rule is implicit in a person being qualified to hold the office, but still, this is a bit simplistic. It is perfectly fine if the rule is take this and bring it from point A to point B when the alarm sounds, for example. But what of more intangible rules, such as smile and be friendly, or a popular one in professional services firms, look respectable? And then there are situations where people may simply not understand a rule or what a rule is for. Ralph gave examples of how deployed military personnel of lower ranks would not understand what their mission was for because it was not a function of their office to hold such knowledge. But if you're asking devotion from bureaucrats, in military or otherwise, they, as humans, would certainly want to know what it is that they're working towards and why. And how about situations where there are simply too many rules? We concluded that for Weber, rules are an absolute good, so it does not seem that there is a space in his system for counterproductive rules. But in practice, rules function in an absolute sense to either safeguard against something really dangerous, or as a form of socialization into the organization. The idea there is that one studies rules in order to understand how the organization works, but once such understanding is achieved, the person is expected to be able to introduce flexibility into the rule following. And that's more or less it. If you haven't listened to the episode yet, I hope that this summary will have enticed you to do so. And if you did listen, I hope that this was a good reminder. My key takeaway from the discussion of bureaucracy was that bureaucracy is about reducing uncertainty and not increasing efficiency. But even this depends on where you are in the organization, of course.
Now, since episode 6, we have covered the topic of bureaucracy directly and indirectly throughout this program. We have attacked it and defended it with equal vigor. But at some point, the discourse has to move toward a so what moment. Because the love-hate discourse on bureaucracy has moved beyond an academic discussion. It is actively defining opposing views on how society and its organizations should operate. Max Weber grounded this discourse in the concept of the iron cage of bureaucracy, which comes from a passage in a different work than we covered in the episode, from The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism from 1905. Toward the end of the final chapter in the book, Weber wrote the following. And this is in the Talcott Parsons translation. The Puritan wanted to work in a calling. We are forced to do so. For when asceticism was carried out of monastic cells into everyday life and began to dominate worldly morality, it did its part in building the tremendous cosmos of the modern economic order. This order is now bound to the technical and economic conditions of machine production, which today determine the lives of all the individuals who are born into this mechanism with irresistible force. Perhaps it will so determine them until the last ton of fossilized coal is burnt. In Baxter's view, the care for external goods should only lie on the shoulders of the, quote, saint like a light cloak which can be thrown aside at any moment, end quote. But fate decreed that the cloak should become an iron cage. Now, is this a bleak prediction? One so unique to bureaucracies or rationalism in general? We should perhaps step back and ask what went wrong, both actual and perceived. Now, as with any complex system, maximized strengths can become vulnerabilities, and bureaucracy is no exception. In a bureaucracy and the bureaucratic logic, the source of authority is typically determined by hierarchical position, one which may or may not indicate anything about the quality of the individual holding that position. The fictional Bill Lumberg, a senior manager figure in the 1999 movie Office Space, is the archetypical toxic manager who abuses his position and shows complete indifference towards the workers. The comic strip Dilbert had the pointy-haired boss who was utterly clueless. This pattern that hierarchical organizations seem to promote the wrong people was so compelling and so strong that it was memorialized in a famous satirical book, The Peter Principle, which we covered in episode 112. The principle itself, whereby employees are promoted until they reach their level of incompetence, struck a nerve among workers tired of being micromanaged or pushed around. Other qualities of bureaucratic logics present other difficulties if they're maximized. The reliance on standing operating procedures, or SOPs, as the basis for getting anything done is seen as the inevitable result of over-rationalization. The creative solution is no longer welcome. Rather, things must be done according to procedure at the pace dictated by that procedure. The irony is that rationalization was supposed to provide a path to meritocracy, and now meritocracy is among the reasons for breaking bureaucracies apart. Administrative oversight and audits present another tension. Initially created to validate the efficiency of operation, they are now criticized as generating significant amounts of work that produce little for the consumer or client, and becomes a weight around the ankles of workers and managers alike. Complaints about reports and meetings and other artifacts of corporate culture have been lampooned in popular media and covered in various episodes in our program, such as Wilmot's critique of corporate culturism, covered in episode 30, and Gideon Kunda's study of engineered culture and control in episode 49. A great source of tension over bureaucracy has been building as government bureaucracies have been criticized for being bloated and wasteful as a natural result of over-rationalization. And it's easy to see why. Virtually all of us at some point in our lives will have run up against a situation where something that should be easy suddenly becomes difficult and we're unable to understand why. Or someone in the government office has said no to our request, often when we are most dependent upon that request being granted, such as anything involving healthcare or unemployment benefits. Or the person serving us came across as rude because of the impersonality of it all. Those instances will overshadow the probable hundreds or thousands of times that the bureaucracy worked properly, many times in ways invisible to us. And so as we enter the next phase of digitization, bureaucracy is not only unwelcome, but is the target. The portrayal of digitization is that it should free people from the iron cage of bureaucracy, but that belief is worth questioning. I'll offer a couple of explanations, but this is not meant to be comprehensive. One is algorithmic management. This topic has been covered in our program several times, and it has been a recurring theme. Back in episode 18, we commented on a Financial Times article, When Your Boss is an Algorithm, by Sarah O'Connor, and then held our own first symposium on the gig economy and algorithmic management back in episode 40. Now, at that time, algorithmic management was newer and perhaps still a bit scary. Now it's fully integrated in so many aspects of work and life, it's difficult to keep up. Ostensibly pursued to break free of bureaucracy or to make it much more efficient, digitization merely created some of its own rationalizations, one may argue. There's little question that there have been benefits. No doubt customers of ride services like Uber greatly appreciate the predictability and reliability of calling for a ride today. But at the same time, the logic of rating systems present difficulties when either the driver or the rider have had bad experiences or either party decides to act maliciously, such as the rider spitefully giving a one-star review that was undeserved because of a perceived slight or they're in a foul mood. As artificial intelligence technologies advance, there is another problem, the lack of transparency over the rules. Personally, having worked in the early days of AI back in the 1990s, I was aware of the potential challenges that AI theorists were thinking about and that the systems would probably develop rules that could never be explained. Now, fast forward to today, this remains true, although there certainly have been major advances being made to train AIs to explain their reasoning. The second consideration is a paradox of choice. Yannis Gabriel wrote about glass cages and glass palaces in several works in which he suggested that the time of the Iron Cage was passing, and his earliest work was in 1970. The glass cage metaphor is not so much anti-bureaucratic, but it may instead reframe the rigidness of bureaucracy in the ways that are familiar in the present time. He uses glass not because of its transparency, but because of how it is commonly used in storefronts for control displays and enticements, which is why he called it the glass palace. However, once inside, the glass palace can become a cage in which the consumer, seeking to purchase or take advantage of the goods and services that look so great from the outside, may feel stuck or entrapped, finding it difficult to leave. At the same time, they may be enticed by other glass palaces that are now visible to them from the inside. That is, higher-end services that require more money, that sort of thing. In similar fashions, workers may find themselves in glass cages as the quality of work becomes secondary to the workers needing the skills to, quoting Gabriel, to the workers needing the skills to, quote, manipulate images and signs, aesthetic and emotional displays, end quote, and master adaptability and emotional intelligence. Long-term loyalty or commitment within firms are replaced with the need to continuously look for opportunities elsewhere and chase them as they arise. Although discussed as a postmodern take on bureaucracy, it is worth asking to what extent it merely rearranges the bureaucratic rules. Or as Gabriel put it, quote, ambivalence, confusion, and anxiety become associated with new, different forms of entrapment, end quote. And then the third one is just the antipathy itself toward bureaucracy. And the question of, how does one eliminate or reduce bureaucracy without replacing it with something worse or effectively the same thing all over again? We should probably start by reframing the question as a constructive one. What do we want to build rather than merely what do we want to break? That is to say, merely trying to undo the bad parts of bureaucracy. A short list of qualities is offered here for debate. The first is the question of agency. The post-pandemic era, the Great Resignation, arguments about remote work and flexibility have all kind of come about through the expression of individual workers' desires for agency and the challenges of firms or organizations being able to provide or accommodate it. This brings up the natural paradoxical tension between the needs of the individuals and the needs of the collective organization in whatever solution is developed. Second is speed. The need for reliability and predictability does not by itself justify slowness. In the spirit of they who hesitate are lost, unnecessary delays of any sort due to bureaucratic rules can definitely translate into lost competitive advantage. The third one is innovation. Of course, it's a popular view that flexibility and innovation are good, and despite the gnashing of teeth over AI, those successful in adopting it so far and overcoming its limitations are at an advantage. So then how can the rules enable innovation rather than just merely get in the way? Some quick cautions, however, whatever becomes the new form of bureaucracy still has to preserve some form of productive reliability and stability simply because certain services and goods demand it. Healthcare, utilities are among them, but they are complex. Healthcare is especially complex. And as we discussed in our episode 134 on Perot's normal accidents, complexity and tightly coupled systems are prone to catastrophic disaster, which can be ill afforded in healthcare and utilities, for example. Guardrails still need to be in place in some form. There's also concerns about the return of favoritism. One of the primary reasons behind Weberian bureaucracy was to get rid of favoritism. Reducing bureaucracy should not necessitate a return to such favoritism, but it's important that certain meritocratic principles be reinforced. What we don't want necessarily is that social capital becomes the measure of merit filling any void as bureaucracy is reduced. And finally, the roles of the human in or on the loop. The limitations of artificial intelligence limits the desires of some to completely undo bureaucracy. Regardless of what happens with AI technologies in the future, there will be roles for humans to supplement the AI tools and avoid wrong answers, hallucinations, and so on. Now, what will emerge as best practices could very well develop into new roles for the humans and rules that humans and AI tools must follow.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.